It's Saturday, the week after Mass Effect 3 came out, and you're listening to episode 261 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 52 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
This is Wayne.
My name's Chad.
My name's Pat.
Two quick announcements. Neither of these should be a surprise to anyone who's been listening to us. First off, Fear the Con 5. Whole bunch of games just got posted. Sign up still remains open all the way up until about a week before the convention. So if you're not signed up already, get out there and join us May 3rd for the Wing Night, 4th and 5th for the gaming. And also there will be a week of tourism starting on that Sunday and then running through the Wing Night on Thursday.
You know what I'm really excited about besides just the con in general and everything about it?
Your mom.
And that. The t-shirt design.
Yes.
Oh, yes.
I love that design. I'm going to buy three.
Rubens, Save versus DM, he created a t-shirt design for us and also a general branding logo for the convention, which looks great.
Yes.
And as of probably not this show, but next show, I'll try to have the Fear the Con shirts available. Maybe by this show, just check the show notes. It depends on how long it takes me to set up the Cafe Press stuff. So if not this show, next one. The second thing is the Power 16-3 is still going on.
Epic
battle of epicness.
I went out there and looked at the results, and there are some where there's pretty clear winners. There are others where they're almost perfect. 50-50
Every
splits.
Vote. Counts
and counts and counts,
counts and counts. I mean, we just put this thing up on SurveyMonkey, so you could just keep hitting that five all day.
Every vote counts for one, so vote a lot.
Yes. Pat, who are you voting for? Yeah, I know. I get you.
All right, so we had a topic picked out for today, which is we're going to talk about faith and role-playing games, and we're also going to do a little bit of a throwdown on some urban fantasy stuff, but unfortunately, Chris is not available, and he really wanted to be involved in this one. I can't win, because I need both Wayne and Chris, and I'm just trading off between
They're the same person. They're never on the same mics at the same time.
That's true.
I am not Chris.
See? Only someone who is Chris would say that.
Yeah, yeah.
That's only one true test. Wayne, say penis.
Penis.
No, he's not Chris.
No, no.
Yeah.
That didn't creep me. It was only a little creepy, but it didn't totally creep me
out. It sounded more like the Merriam-Webster Talking Dictionary.
Yes.
It did not sound like, he didn't mean it. He didn't feel it.
Yeah.
Well,
he didn't feel it, all right.
Penis.
Closer. You needed the false start of a few sentences.
Wait, I'll tell you.
That's what I was trying with the
Do some push-ups first and then say it again.
Ah.
So what we're going to do instead today is Chad went out on our Twitter feed and basically said, hey, what would you guys like to hear us talk about? And we got a bunch of great suggestions. Obviously, we can't talk about all of them, but we have several here that you guys suggested, which we're going to talk about, and we will credit where credit is due.
So are you saying Chad is putting out content for this show?
I done it. That is the proper grammar of sending out a tweet, or so I have said. Just on these mics just
now. I believe it to be true. And I probably have to bleep that word out. If you can't figure out what we're saying through the bleeps, just start conjugating twit or tweet in various ways. You'll get there. All right. But Chad did have an idea that we might try at some point in the future, which is if we did a rapid fire episode where we just let people hit us on Twitter prior to the show with just anything. And they would all have to be stuff we could answer quickly, like within a couple minutes. And we just rapid fire through like 20 or 30 questions in the course of one show. We might do that.
Any question you want to ask us, and we just hit it.
Yeah. So that's not what we're doing this show, though. We have picked out three. There's two that kind of tie together. I'm going to tie them together the way I approach it. But let's start off with one that came from church. And
hey, nope, no religion.
Okay, it came from Tyler, who goes by church.
That's what's better. What's his at Twitter thing?
Oh, church traveler. Something to that effect. Traveler? Well, there's a saying on the forums.
Well, you know,
forums.
He is going to be running traveler.
There's a saying on the forums. Go to church. He's running traveler. So,
right.
What church wrote is he said,
in the first day, Dan spake.
You know, Chad, actually, it's funny you bring up that Dan spake thing. I found a thing online where you can like put up like a resume. Kai Gaden put it up there. It's a link to where you can go to put up a voice acting profile. And I am a terrible narrator. I tried it and just flopped. I think I've mentioned this on the show. But I bet I could do a single character pretty well.
Uh-huh.
I could not do the full narrative. So I think I'm going to put a profile
What
up
character
there.
Would you do?
I'll do several. Because you can actually, you can do like a demo. And
no,
I'll probably.
What character would you do? Because you said you can do one. Oh, I see. Your problem with narrating is you can't switch.
Exactly.
Yeah, gotcha.
But if, for example, someone said, hey, we'd love to have you like in a video game or a cartoon as this guy.
Right.
I could do that. I just can't do the whole narrative.
You can't do the old lady. You can't do the big tough guy.
Right.
You
can't go I can't do the all at once.
What if it were a novel about Knowles? Because you can do 20 Knowles mixing and matching at a time.
Well, the one
all
novel.
Those Knowles look and sound alike.
Bigot. All of them can sing and dance too, right?
That's right.
And the one novel I ever thought about actually trying to do in audio fiction form was first person, because of the fact that I would only have to do one voice and one character, because everything that occurs is told through the eyes of that one character. And so there is no alternate voice. There is no third person narrative. All right. But anyway, what Church wrote in was he said, when a well-loved NPC gets killed, it can affect the game. How do you make and hook that NPC to players? Great question.
The NPC's character sheet and you staple it bodily to the players. They are very attached to that NPC then. Ba-dun-tsh.
Wow. With that you sounded like the Count on Sesame Street finishing a joke that wasn't funny. All right, let's start off.
I just thought he sounded like Chad finishing a joke that wasn't funny.
One unfunny joke.
You've got more than one in this episode so far.
All right, let's start off with a caveat he gave in there, which is well-loved. All right, when we talk about this, we are not talking about the character they all love to hate and then finally got to kill. Making a compelling villain is a completely different topic and has a completely different approach. We are talking here about an NPC that the party likes, gets attached to, and then something happens or might happen to that character such that they are removed from the game, which can obviously impact the players on an emotional level. The same way if you're watching a movie and a character you really like dies, that affects you on some level, okay? That kind of changes your perception of the story. How I want to approach this is I want to reverse engineer this, because I was trying to think of like, well, how do you set out to make this kind of a character? Which internally kind of led me to the question of, well, what makes a character that fits this profile, that's well-loved and people are attached to? And so I thought, well, maybe it'd be best to actually go the other direction of let's talk about some NPCs that have fit that bill that we really loved, we're really attached to. It always made our day when that character showed up and may or may not have died in the game. But if they had died, it would have affected the game negatively. And Wayne, I'm going to start with you.
In the Knights of Rainsborough game, there is a character called Lester. He's kind of a dorky, lovable loser that has built a supercomputer off in a corner room. And the character, absolutely everyone fell in love with this character. You know, first time we saw him, he was in mortal danger, and my superhero character's trying to save him. By the end of that first storyline, I would have gladly sacrificed my character to save this NPC's life, because it is that interesting of a character.
Why?
And that's the thing. When you look at it, there's not one thing you can put towards it other than it is a fully developed personality. He is the lovable loser. Yeah, it's a archetype, but
the
thank you, Wayne. Pat just cringed. And
it's amazing how the soundboard can like make
it kind of react.
It can react without even making a
it's
sound.
It's like Wall-E. More than talk, it just kind of emotes.
Yes.
But when I look at the character and try to figure out what it is, I was hooked on it. You know, the character had its own voice. We were talking actually voice acting, things like that. It had its own unique audible voice that was different.
Right.
It was the lovable loser type character. You know, you wanted to save him, but he was down on his luck, you know, sacrificed all of his money to build this thing. I don't really know what about it hooked me other than it was an interesting character, and everyone else really loved this character too.
Let me toss something out there just as a thought. When Sam Raimi was doing the Spider-Man movies, one of the things that he tried to do with Peter Parker was put him in all of these just really socially awkward, cringeworthy experiences, because one, it builds sympathy for the character, and two, because of the fact that all of us feel like that some of the time, all of the time, whatever. You could put yourself in his shoes. You wanted to see him succeed. you wanted to see him stop embarrassing himself because you've been there too. Is it something like that?
I think it might be. And part of it is in an RPG, you're not just watching him thinking, man, if things could just turn out better. In an RPG, you actually have the chance to interact and help him. And that's part of it because, you know, you see this character that's down on his luck and you want to do something for it.
That's a good one.
And then now, as a character, I can interact with this character, get to know the character more, try to help it.
So we're not just talking relatability, but you also bring up the point of accessibility, that this is not someone who's a fixture of the world, but is actually someone that you can contribute towards the path of.
Yeah, you want this character to be happy, and you can do something about it.
Okay, so you buy in on the front end and invest on the back end. Okay,
yeah.
I get that. Those are some great ideas. Chad, what about you?
I can't really think of any specific one. I think of a couple, like the mercenary Skies of Glass game we played. There was the muffin lady who lived next door to our quote-unquote base. And
we all love the muffin lady.
The muffin lady literally was a baker.
Yes.
She lived right next door to, as Chad said, where mm-hmm. they were. And so she would pretty regularly bring you guys these like apple muffins in the morning and such. Really no idea what you were really
doing. Right, right. We were just.
Or didn't care.
Didn't care. And we were, you know, we were mercenaries and we were this and that. And to her, in her eyes, we were just lovable kids. We were the nice boys who lived next door.
You know, Dan had a unique voice for her, too.
Yes.
I know that's something that helps me get immersed in a game is when the GM is capable of doing an interesting voice for a character.
What's interesting about him is that the types of characters that I see people really latching into, it has nothing to do with their importance or what they can do or anything like that. It isn't necessarily even characters that have a really detailed background and history. It could be the type of NPC that we say has sprung up from the earth. You know, they just erupted from the ground. They don't have a backstory. They don't have parents. They don't have any of that written. But they have emotions and personality quirks that you can identify and that really hook in and that you could really relate to. They're very real. Even in a fantastic setting, they seem very real because their personality and emotions seem very real.
There's one thing you said in there that I think is extremely important, which is that a game master ought not confuse importance with attachment.
Mm-hmm.
You can have an NPC who is important and yet the players don't care. You can have an NPC that the players care about and yet is unimportant. Now, they're not mutually exclusive. You can have one that's both. Mm-hmm. You can have one that's the focus of the plot and they also really care about this character. But they do not have to be the same. There just has to be something about that character that grabs people. So what is it about the muffin lady that specifically grabbed you?
You know, this is going to sound silly. She was nice to us.
Yeah.
There were other characters who were polite and civil, and there were other characters who were mean, and you know, we were in a town, and it ran the gamut. But she was very nice to us in a very innocent sort of way, and part of our character's thing is that we were teenagers, and nobody took us seriously, and we were going on this path of doing something very dangerous and very adult. And we were taking it as seriously as teenagers can take it. So on one hand, we were taking it overly seriously. And on the other hand, we weren't taking it seriously enough. All the adults saw us through that kind of lens, that these are a bunch of kids who shouldn't be doing this. Or, well, I don't agree with what they're doing, but I can't stop them and that sort of thing. She didn't treat us like that. As characters, she was just really nice to us, and she was a neighbor, and she was a nice person. That really accentuated the fact that we were teenagers and that we were outsiders.
She was kind of a motherly character for a group of characters that really needed a motherly character.
Yes.
I think the word I would pick is not necessarily motherly, but neighborly.
Yes.
Chad, one of the things as you're talking that I see in that is if we look at real life, we have allies and we have enemies. But just because someone is an ally does not necessarily mean they're a friend.
Mm-hmm.
You might have someone who's nice to you, who's pulling for you, whatever. But if you look at the reasons you get attached to somebody in real life, you know, if you had an old lady who lived next door who every morning brought you fresh baked muffins, you're going to develop an affinity for this person. Yeah. And
but that doesn't mean that she's your best friend in the world. And that's very real. You as a person, I'm not even talking in a game here, I'm talking you as a person, you have more of these people in your life than you do real close friends. Because real close friends are something that you develop and it takes time, and you might have a lot of friends, but you have more acquaintances.
Right.
Role-playing games, really abstract things. It's like you said, you have people who are your allies and friends. You have people who are your enemies. You have people who are neither or nothing. They're the shopkeeper, the tavern, right. Strangers, basically, who populate the world. And in all the times I've been gaming, this middle ground between a stranger and a friend, someone who isn't a stranger, but they're not a friend, that is so prevalent in everyone's real life, that type of character does not come up very much in a role-playing game, because that's usually not what stories are about.
Right.
I think that putting that character in there, especially for that game and that kind of character, not to say that neighborly, motherly, muffin lady, but I'm just talking that type of character, that middle ground character, really adds a lot of real to the game. And it was very good for those characters to have that, because it made that base and that town seem more like home. And that type of character really, like I said, really contrasted with all of our characters a lot, because we were nothing like her in any way, and she was nothing like us. It's very hard to describe, because it wasn't emotional, it wasn't deep, it wasn't like, oh my god, this lady and her freaking muffins, yes!
I actually never said much of anything about her.
Yeah.
I mentioned at one point, I think, that she was a widow,
mm-hmm.
and obviously you knew what she did by trade. Where you guys were based out of Cape Girardeau had a notable farming community and had some apple orchards and such nearby, which is where she was getting the material from, that she was mm-hmm. making this food. But beyond that, I really never said a whole lot about her.
And we didn't pursue it.
Yeah.
Because she's not our friend. And she's not a stranger. She's this acquaintance.
Dan, I think you hit on something that Chad hit on earlier, too, when you say that you didn't really mention much about her. Chad made a comment, it doesn't matter if this is a character that sprung from the ground, or if you have, you know, pages of backstory to the character, it's sometimes about the personality. I think that's very much the case. You could have 4 pages of backstory on a character, then the character still be the most boring character in the world, that I'm not going to care about that NPC. Or you could just have, I walk into a store and I meet somebody that you create off the top of your head, and that then becomes a major interesting NPC just because of the personality it was given.
Right. And I think it bears mentioning that just as importance does not lead to investment, in the same way, depth does not automatically lead to investment.
Mm-hmm.
Once again, they're not mutually exclusive. You can have a character who's important, deep, and the players are invested in this person, but they don't have to be. You know, those little acts of kindness or whatever it is that gets to your specific players can create the kind of an attachment. Pat, what about you?
Mine is very similar to like what Wayne had said. In one of my longstanding campaigns, there was an NPC that traveled and adventured with the party. So, I mean, it was a NPC that was much closer than just a sort of a tertiary character that you just see every once in a while. But really the interesting thing about it was that the character didn't die, but there was one point where he was mortally wounded, and it was interesting to see the reaction to that. This was not one of the player characters, obviously. It wasn't one of the, around the table that you would, really think that you'd be mostly upset if one of them died. This was the sort of the NPC that was being played by the GM that went along with this, sort of as our pocket healer. But we were very attached to this character. Really, what unfolded was that when this happened, it sidelined an entire session or couple of sessions where it went from, sort of completing the mission for that. It was making sure that this person was nursed back to health. The result of it was like critical hit, and our GM, he had his own critical hit tables that were relatively nasty. And it was, I think he rolled like a double critical. So, you roll a critical hit, you roll a die 100 on the chart, and he rolled a 100, and that's roll again or something like that. And then he rolled 100 again. So it's like, or something like that. So it's like, it wasn't immediate death, but he was like throat shot. He was near death and he was maimed. And, so after that we as a party spent a large sum of money, because this was a low to medium magic setting where you don't just have the resurrections or the regenerate spells, like the drop of a hat. We basically pooled our money to make, to bring Dullness back to health. It didn't surprise me, seeing it, because we were living it and we're like, oh my God, we've got to do this because he's our friend and we've become attached to him. And the question, Churchill was talking about, how do you engineer this? How do you do this? And my take on that is you don't force it. It's not something that can be forced. And I think that's, we've been sort of jumping around this around the table as we've been talking, but it doesn't matter what you try to do as a GM. You cannot come up with an NPC that is going to be like this for the party that you think is going to be that way.
Yes.
It's going to just happen like falling off an apple cart. It's literally just going to be something small or little is going to happen. Like a good point is like interesting NPCs, like, you know, you go into the tavern and you meet the barkeep, or there's a shopkeeper that you meet for the first time, or the muffin lady. And it's literally like, it's that first interaction.
Yeah.
Something magical happens. There's some just magical interaction that's memorable to either one or more of the players at the session. And they sort of latch onto that. And then I think, you know, the GM will see that. And it's that spark. That spark of imagination is fired there, and that's where it comes from.
That's the key, I think. Not trying to, as a GM, not trying to engineer these, but actually watching it and seeing when it happens, and then just, okay, that's the character that they've latched onto. Now, how can I bring that character more into the campaign?
And I think, I would say that for every NPC that this spark catches on and takes hold, there's probably 5 to 10 others that were just missed by whoever, either by the other characters or by the GM. I think, you know, it's just one of the things where kismet happens and it sort of comes to a head. So just have to be aware.
You are absolutely right. You cannot engineer this kind of investment any more than you can engineer a friendship or romantic relationship in real life. Now, I think you can sit down, look at the players, look at the kinds of things they're interested in, look in your own gaming experience at the kinds of things that made you buy into an NPC. And you might be able to set up a character that fits that bill.
Mm-hmm.
But in the same way as there have been people I've known where on paper, we should have gotten along wonderfully. We had everything in common, all this stuff lined up, but for some reason that spark just never occurred. And conversely, there are people that I associate with that I don't have a huge amount in common with. And yet for some reason, there's an attachment there. Now, in some cases, I can sit down and I can really search myself and work out these subconscious reasons of why that happened. You know, maybe there's something about them that reminds me of somebody that I knew who was important in my life. Maybe there's something about them where the first impression I had of them was just a really good one. They made the joke I needed to hear because everyone was thinking it, and they were the first one that had the balls to say it. There's all kinds of reasons that attachment may form, but you cannot force a sentiment.
Mm-hmm.
You can't sit down and say, well, here's a 3-step process to make this happen. And Wayne, the thing that I would say in response to you is once it happens, I think the GM has to be very careful with that.
Yeah.
Because just as you cannot engineer it starting.
Too much Muffin Lady is too much.
Precisely. Muffin Lady. And Muffin Lady, to put that in context, I was not in the game Pat's talking about. And obviously I can't speak to what Aaron's doing in the Rainsborough game. But in the case of the Muffin Lady, I can tell you that she was one of a list of color characters in that town. I did not pick her out to be a person of importance to you guys on any emotional level. I never,
because she was not a person.
Yeah,
she was not an important person.
Right. And the place had tons of color characters who had no plot significance. The grandfather, he had no plot significance.
The grandfather was good for a couple of scenes, and then it's like, that was it.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't really want to deal, personally, I didn't really want to deal with the grandfather too much. He was good for, like,
That was my grandfather.
It was your grandfather. Like, he was good for your
character. I was more attached to him.
Yeah.
That was one of those where you get attachment for maybe one or a couple characters, but not for everybody around the table. And that's the other thing. You will get that. You'll definitely get some NPCs that maybe one or two people are really attached to, but the rest of the group don't really care about.
Yeah. Right.
So that's the other thing, is the rarity is finding that one where it's universal, or almost everybody is, like, you know, of that level with that NPC.
Yeah. And while I don't think you can engineer those, I do think for individual players, you can kind of predict which characters they might latch on to. Like, I know running something for Pat, he's a father. He is a very fatherly person. So his characters always want to take care of lost children, women. He is a protective character. So I know if I have a lot of NPCs available that he could run into that need a protector, there's a good chance that one of those he'll latch onto.
Mm-hmm.
We can't actually go through and engineer this is the character he will latch onto, but I can have a bunch of them out there and know that there's a good chance, because I know him as a player or as a person, that he's going to latch onto one of them.
Mm-hmm.
The character that came to my mind, I'm trying to come up with one, it was Chad from a Skies of Glass game of yours. I guess I'll turn this right back at
I've
you.
I've only run one, so.
But we were playing a group who had gotten into it with a bunch of bandits or something like that. And these bandits were from a particular town that we were not from. And we ended up in the kind of run and gun, bomb throwing, really chaotic battle.
I killed the party.
And at the end of that,
I'm not surprised.
At the end of that,
want to.
We ended up killing these guys fairly close to the hometown. And the mayor comes out. And Chad pretty much instantly described this mayor as a man who at least outwardly had modeled himself after an image of Abraham Lincoln. Mm-hmm. He had the beard. He had the stovepipe top hat. I mean, all that kind of stuff.
He wasn't crazy.
No, he wasn't. It was just the image he chose of this is what a leader must look like or some. Mm-hmm. I don't remember his backstory in detail.
Yeah.
But he came out of that town. And of course, the image was immediately striking. It was immediately relatable and unusual because here you are in a near future post nuke setting, looking at a guy who has modeled himself after Abraham Lincoln. Okay, this is already kind of really weird and memorable. But then he comes out, basically asks us point blank, did you guys kill these boys? To which we pretty much, you know, kind of grabbing our guns said, yeah. He walks over to one of them, spits on him, and says, good. They were nothing but trouble anyway. And that, you know, that instant moment of, oh my gosh, this guy's totally cool.
Yeah.
You know, it's like having a cop pull you over. And he says, you were doing 80 and a 35, and he starts laughing about it and then sends you on your way. Okay, I'm not suggesting do this. But my point being that...
Good luck finding that cop.
Yeah, in my case, he would laugh about it, joke about it, and then give me the ticket.
Yeah.
It's like getting off the hook. I mean, look, okay, several people here have kids. Have you ever had a moment where you've had trouble disciplining your kid because what they did was wrong, but it was really damn funny?
Oh, yeah, all the time.
And
it's awesome.
Imagine if you, at that point in time, let's say you're babysitting somebody else's kid, and they do something that they know is wrong, and instead of disciplining them, you just start cracking up. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you're going to win instant brownie points with that kid. And that's why I had this immediate connection with the mayor. Here's this guy who's visually very memorable. And the first thing we get is he busts us doing something that needed to be done. But, you know, villages take care of their own. We figured this wasn't going to end well. And instead, good for you guys, pats us on the back and welcomes us in.
Yeah.
So it's interesting as we went around the table, I noticed that while there were a small number of trends, such as relatability, accessibility, that spark, we also gave, honestly, in the details, very different answers.
Mm-hmm.
I talked about an important NPC. Pat talked about an NPC who's there all the time. Wayne talked about an NPC who has a lot of background and depth. Chad talked about an NPC who was flavor. We all latched on to different kinds of NPCs for different reasons.
I can practically taste those apple muffins.
And so I think really the advice that I would give from this is what we were just talking about, which is, yes, there are steps you can take, but you cannot make that magic happen. What you can do, though, is once it has happened, don't overplay that character, but also do, in a limited, controlled way, take advantage of what that character means. Let's say this Muffin Lady, let's say that Skies of Glass game had continued on, and Muffin Lady at some point did have a problem. Is, which are bandits in Skies of Glass, right, come into the town, and she ends up being injured. And she needs an antibiotic that this town does not possess. You guys probably would have taken it upon yourselves to resolve that. Now, that's not overplaying it. It's not like she's there every minute of every day. She's the new focal point of the plot. It turns out she's secretly the primary antagonist or protagonist. You know, it doesn't.
That would have been awesome, though.
Yes.
But
the muffins have been slowly poisoning us this entire time. And there's only one antidote.
That's right.
Go.
Well, she put the apple seeds in the muffins as well, so we were being dosed with cyanide.
Nice.
All right. So the next one we've got comes from Eric. Eric asked a question, and this is going to tie into, at least where I'm going to go with this, a question somebody else asked.
Boxer briefs. Next question.
Depends. The question depends on the day of the week.
Oh. Yeah, sure you did.
Eric asked the question, should RPG books contain advice on how to handle problematic social situations that happen during the game? Wayne and I, in trying to figure out whether this topic had legs, pretty immediately disagreed. So I'm going to state my opinion. I'll go first this time, and then I will let Wayne fail while attempting to... I'll let him embarrass himself attempting to prove me wrong.
Hey, I just want to say I am the lovable loser of this podcast.
They'll let the fans vote on that. Is Wayne lovable?
What is each of the...
Yeah, we don't need to vote on the loser part.
What are each of the hosts' tropes do each of what one TV trope do each of us fulfill?
You know, that's the feedback I want to hear from this episode. For anyone listening to it, I want to see feedback of what trope do each of us fit.
Do you know how many people are going to TVtropes.com right now? And do you know how many days, work hours you have just blown away from America?
An insufficient number.
Yes.
That's right.
So my answer to this question is no. And here's why.
What was the question again?
We don't know.
Is Wayne a lovable loser? Should RPG books contain advice on how to handle problematic social situations that happen during the game? And my advice on this, or my answer to this, is no. And here's why. I was reading a commentary by Ryan Dancy, and I realize he's kind of a divisive person, but in this particular thing, I think the dude was right on. And he was talking about getting new people into the hobby. And what he said in the course of this little essay, he felt one of the mistakes that a lot of RPG books were making was attempting to initiate people to the concepts of RPGs. His comment, and once again, I agree with this, is that given video games and all the other accessible versions of RPGs that are out there, people get the idea that this is an interactive story where you play a character and someone or something else moderates the story. What he went on to say is that what you ought to do if you want to capture a new audience is skip past all of that or don't spend a lot of time on it. And instead, focus on getting them into the game as quickly as possible. Don't make it take a long time for them to have to read tons of what is an RPG, how do I create a character, 60 million pages of setting, and this is where I'm going to tie into somebody else's question, but we'll come back to that. But his advice was get them into the game as fast as you can. Other resources can be there, but that's for them to refer back to later. And what I have to think is that if you give the average person an RPG book, they're going to be looking for the information they need to get into it, to get started, to get enjoying the hobby. And if you put in there all this esoteric advice on, well, what do you do when one guy at the table is being a dickwad? I do not think a person is going to want that advice or go looking for that advice until it has happened. It's the same way you don't pay a whole lot of attention to a disease until it hits home. I think in that same sort of way, it is really going to be wasted space in an RPG book. And I don't just say it's because of what we do, but I honestly think that sort of thing is better dealt with in RPG advice books, podcasts, and blogs, not within the course of a role-playing book. Now, Wayne, you disagree with me, at least in some part or whole, yeah, in all of this.
Some part, not in whole.
Okay.
I mean, the big thing for me looking at this, I remember when I was first coming into RPGs, I didn't know what a GM was or a DM. I had no idea of those concepts. I needed to know what those concepts were. When I looked at a role-playing game book, the first time someone handed one to me was actually a GURPS book. I had no idea what GURPS was. I didn't know what it was, didn't know what an RPG was.
And by the end of the book, you had no better idea what GURPS was.
Exactly. As I'm looking at it, I had no idea. I didn't know until years later when I heard the name GURPS after I had been playing games. Then I went back and said, oh, that's what that was he was giving me. Because there are some basic concepts that someone who hasn't played these kind of games really does need to know for their first game. That's why I think some of this stuff for like a beginner's book,
right,
things like that, I think do need some of that. But I think like an advanced player's guide doesn't. And for someone that's just going to grab a book and try to figure out how to run this stuff, yes, you need to get them into the game quickly. I agree with that wholeheartedly. But I do think one of the concepts there for someone who hasn't played a game like this that they have a hard time with, or at least that I had a hard time with, is what exactly is the role of a GM in that game? So I think some level of that needs to be in there. What do you do if your players say they want to do something that's not in the rule books? Just little advice pieces like that in a chapter.
Okay, short bits of advice I'll grant you.
Yes.
And
more advanced stuff obviously should be in a separate advice book.
That was going to be my question, is would you go so far as to say, you know, should more detailed or more unique problems, such as what to do with the problem player? And obviously, the problem player is a category. Problem players are problem players for 1,000 different reasons. Do you think something like that belongs in an RPG book?
Not at all. And that's why I said I didn't completely disagree with you.
Right.
It was only partially. I do think some of this does need to be in there. Some base concepts need to be in there if it's a game you're marketing to new players.
And I've got some other thoughts on how to approach that, how to deal with people who are new to the hobby. But before I get into that, because that's going to lead me down a side road and then eventually into the related question, Chad and Pat, what do you guys think?
Boxer briefs, definitely.
Yeah, I totally agree.
We know what Pat chooses because he showed us last week. Thanks a lot, Chad, for suggesting it.
Now, in my defense, I just suggested boxer briefs. I did not suggest he show them to me.
You know him well enough to know he's going to do it.
Yeah.
I know.
My eyes said yes.
Huh? Yeah.
No, but yes.
Absolutely. I agree with you, Dan. And I would go so far as I think from a marketing standpoint, putting these books out here, I think I agree with what Dancy says. But for my reason, it would be when I buy a book, if I'm going to buy a new game, yes, I want to get into it as quickly as possible. And furthermore, for my money, I want to buy a book that is filled only with the stuff that I need. Like, I don't need beginner stuff. I don't need the what is the GM or, you know, this or the other or dispute resolution. I want to either pay less for a book that has that stuff cut out of it or pay the same amount for a book that instead of that fluff filler that's in there has more content.
Yeah, and that's why I specifically said I think it works best in beginner's books.
Yeah.
And well, like beginner's boxes and things
and
like that.
And I think doubly so when you look at the amount of free material that is out there on what is an RPG, how do you deal with problems in the game. You know, I think you could have something where...
A little podcast called Fear the Boot.
Right. Yeah. Well, let's look at it this way. Your company that makes games, you could have a one-pager in there that says, hey, if you're struggling with game stuff or need help on some of these concepts or advanced ideas, go to our website, to this URL.
Yeah.
And what you can do is at that URL, paizo.com/resources, you have links to what they consider to be the best maintained and best content sort of blogs and podcasts. Wow, this is a great idea, Eric Mohn. If you're listening, you should totally do this. We totally need to link off your site for your...
Yes.
It's value added to you.
Yes. And it should be listed, all the sites should be listed alphabetically, starting with Fear the Boot.
Yes, precisely. There's nothing good A through E. It's not even A through F, D.
Yeah.
The way that I was looking at this, and this ties into the second question. There was a gentleman by the name of William who wrote in, it was kind of a three-part question, but two of the parts were on setting bloat and improving or speeding up character creation within a rules book. We'll talk about setting bloat either a little bit later in this episode or maybe in some future episode. But let's talk for the moment about improving or speeding up character creation, since this ties into what we're already talking about. One of the things that came to my mind when thinking about this topic is something that I have seen in a couple different productivity software suites and also a couple of video games. The easiest one for me was Civ 5. When you go to Civ 5 and you look in the help menu, you can pick how much you want the game to give you tips and tutorials. And there are several levels. There's a level for I've never played Civ before. There's a level for I've played Civ 5, leave me alone. And there's this mid-level in there of, well, I'm familiar with the Civ series, but this is my first outing with Civ 5, to where it's not going to tell you, well, this is what food and shields do, but it is going to tell you, this is what we changed in this game. Here's how culture now works. And it's going to explain the little nuance and difference between Civ 4 and Civ 5 or Civ 3 and Civ 5 or whatever. And when I was outlining a rule book for Epoch Horizons, just kind of thinking, like, if I did this, how would I do this? One of the things that I did was I gave myself a page budget because I said, look, I want to convey these ideas as succinctly as possible. Chad, you talk all the time about Stephen King's On Writing. I've never read his book On Writing.
It's a great book.
I did read an essay he wrote for, it was either 2002 or 2003 Writer's Handbook, which I think may have been taken from On Writing, where he talked about his first job as a writer was writing for a sports column in his school newspaper. Mm-hmm. And he talked about how, despite what everybody thinks, that the hard part is filling out the word count. He actually found it was a reverse thing. It's saying your ideas in a concise form. And what his editor told him to do, and I don't mean his professional editor, I mean the editor of this like school newspaper told him to do, was I want you to cut the number of words in half and say the same idea. And so what I did was I set forth a page budget. I said, okay, I'm going to explain the concepts of role-playing games, but I'm going to give myself 2 pages to do it. If I can't do it in 2 pages, I've lost the attention of my reader. we're going to do character creation. I don't remember the budget. I have this worked out in a Word document or Google document somewhere. But I said, okay, we're going to do character creation. And I broke that down into discrete steps. Attributes gets one page and skills gets two pages. And I created this budget that I was going to force myself to stick to as a way of making sure that I wasn't bogging the book down with things that either people did not care about at the moment or may not need to know at all because they already know it. But there is at least a little something there in case somebody wants it.
For a new player grabbing a book, if there's all of this information, it can be very overwhelming. I do agree that it should be definitely shrunk down for things like that, but you want to have options there as well. So I love the idea of your character creation is going to fit in this section, but you can have links to other places in the book, particularly if it's a PDF version or something, you really can't have links. Otherwise, just go to page number. So attributes are in this section. Skills. Here's everything you need to know about skills. Now, your list of skills is chapter 7.
Let's move on then. Let's talk about improving or speeding up character creation and setting bloat. Let's start with improving or speeding up character creation. I think one of the things that I would start by looking at in any rule system is what type of experience is this game trying to portray? What range of characters should be possible? What parts of the character are important enough to require some kind of mechanical conflict resolution, and be pretty hard on yourself about what doesn't need to be in there. You do not necessarily have to have a mechanic for everything. You just need a mechanic for the things this game is meant to capture and portray. Skies of Glass may benefit from a system on survival, tracking disease and infection. A far future sci-fi where antibiotics are not only there, but they are vastly improved, does not need that sort of a system. And I think the same thing is true of character creation. Is everything that you need on your sheet, one, necessary? And two, is it arrived at in a way that is efficient as possible? And I say this as a man who is not averse to crunch. I don't mind crunch. I hate pointless crap. I hate bloat. But I don't mind crunch.
Yeah, I hate confusing numbers on character sheets, but I also hate when I'm playing a system that doesn't give me the ability to really customize the character. If there are so few options that I'm struggling for, how do I make this character look different on paper than, say, Pat's character is on paper? That's a failure to me, too.
Let me give you an example where I'd go the other direction, back to the old FASA Star Trek game. We've talked about this before, where this game starts you off and basically said, okay, you're in your childhood. What were you doing at school? You get so many skill dice to spend on that. What were you doing outside of school? You get so many skill points on that. When you went to the academy, what sort of classes did you enroll in? Mm-hmm. Now, could this system be done more efficiently? Could it have been streamlined? Could this game have benefited from a second, third edition? Yes, absolutely.
I really should play Fate, like the Fate system.
I actually have Fate system books sitting over there. But
Star Trek is good. The old fast Star Trek is good because it is for Star Trek.
Well, but the thing I was going to say I like about the system, and I'll let you get back to Fate here in a sec, but the thing I was going to say about the Star Trek system that I like is even though it's not as streamlined as it could be, there is a purpose to that.
Yes.
It is forcing you to tell the story of this character's life, up to and including you even roll out previous assignments and how well you did, and you have to explain, like, how did I flunk out on this assignment and yet get moved up to a cherry assignment on my next pick.
Why was I on the flagship on the cadet cruise and now I'm on a garbage scowl on my next cadet cruise?
And we
what
actually
happened
just
there?
Created Star Trek characters in my other game where they've chosen to reboot by moving forward in the timeline. And there was one character where they were on a pretty decent assignment, bombed it, and ended up back at the academy. And now you could choose to interpret that. Was he actually busted back to you?
Because the game doesn't interpret.
Or
it
was it
way.
Simply he sucked? We're not actually making him a cadet again, but better to let him go back and do graduate student teaching of 100 level courses than have him wreck another starship.
Yeah. And the game doesn't define this for you in any way. If you don't define it yourself, it's just a mechanical run through.
Right.
And it's just crunch number, crunch number, crunch number, but, and the end result is this. Right. But when you look at it with this critical eye of creating the story and using it to assist the background, I see that's what I want out of a character creation system. D&D is the example of this. I have my stats that define my strength, intelligence, charisma, whatever, and then I have my stats that define how hard I can hit something with a rock. And then I have stats that define how hard I can be hit with a rock. And then I pick out skills. That's fine. I mean, that's fine. It does what it does. That's a very traditional approach. But it doesn't do anything in helping me design the character, the personality, the background, the history. And that's why I really like Fate. Because the Fate character creation system is creating your background. You design your character. And I don't mean you pick a class and you pick all this. You come up with the background, the history of it. You build the character like you would build a world. You come up with your background, you come up with your story, and your background has a mechanical counterpart. It has a mechanical effect. It actually does something. And then it also links the characters together as well. And it creates this group template that is part of the mechanical process of creating it. Star Trek, Fastest Star Trek, same way. Obviously not that soft and that right. that way, but the system helps you design the history and background of your character for that setting, right. for that very specific setting.
On the same lines, that's why sometimes I like to do, like we talked about our 0.25 and 0.5 characters where you just roll and see what stats you come up with. Mm-hmm. I like it for the same reason. You look at the stats and you have to explain how did this person come into existence.
Yeah,
that's but... for a character that I don't have in mind already, though.
See,
if I have a character in mind and I already have the personality and I already know what it does, I want a system that'll let me
see.
I want a character creation system that'll let me build it.
How much I can bench press does not define my character.
And that's a fair point. But I think what it does capture is you do not pick the body you were born in.
Right.
That you
and I have no problem with random run-up of stats.
And you know, there's a reason I'm a computer programmer and not an Olympic weightlifter. It's because of what I was born as. I was born intelligent, but not ridiculously strong beefcake. Yeah, Pat's laughing.
Yeah, and Pat's like, you'll always be a beefcake in my heart.
Right. Basically, the point I was trying to get to with that is, in any character creation system, I want an option for both. I want
you want the beefcake and the intelligent guy.
No, I don't care about that. No, I want the option for either something that is going to help me create a character that I come up with a personality based on what I'm getting. And I want the option to, I already have the character in mind. I know what I want to play. I just want to easily right. look in the book and figure out how to make this character.
See, I want both. I think my punchline answer to William's point about improving or speeding up character creation is that I would not say that those are interchangeable. Improving the character creation system is by figuring out what the game is meant to portray and only dealing with those aspects that are important to the world. That may lead to speeding up character creation, but in cases like Star Trek, I don't mind the fact that it takes a couple hours to create the character because of the fact that that process is useful to the game. Now, as I said before, certainly the process could have used some streamlining in a version 2, which obviously it never got. And maybe some games, that's really all you need to do is pick a few random adjectives, roll a few dice for a limited number of stats, you're ready to go in 10 or 15 minutes. You know, it could be like the Dread thing where you just answer questions about yourself and there really are no stats to your character and you go. And that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that.
One other option is if it's not going to be a quick character creation, Dresden Files takes a long time to create your characters.
Yeah, because you're not just
you're
building the world, you're building the characters,
you're building their ties.
Yeah, you're building the group.
So something to keep in mind, if it's going to take a long time to build your characters, make that process fun. Character creation can be a game. It can be fun in and of itself.
We made characters for Dresden Files. The game was when Dan was on his work hiatus. And we made characters for Dresden knowing that the very next weekend, Dan could be back and we'll never play these characters. We all had a blast making characters because we made some interesting characters in an interesting world. But also Dresden Files was just a really fun game to make characters in. A different idea that I had, too, if you have a system that isn't like Fate or Dread or something like that, that isn't touchy-feely or hippie or whatever you want to call it, that is more crunchy, that is you're running down this algebraic formula and you're putting the formulas onto paper and then it is a mathematical representation of your character. Really, I think it's on publishing companies who are putting this out. Make a character generator online.
Yes.
If it's a mathematical formula, like a standard D&D or a Pathfinder or whatever, just give us a freaking character generator.
Yeah,
and don't charge for it.
For D&D, the best freaking things that happened to D&D in the past decade. It's not any addition. It's not any supplement. It's Mythweavers and the SRD.
Yeah.
You know, and Obsidian Portal, if that's your kind of thing. I mean, it's those sorts of resources. Because
I have no less than 10 Excel spreadsheets that do this kind of thing.
Yeah.
It makes the game easier.
I don't mind D&D character creation. I think it does a good job portraying what the typical D&D game is meant to portray, or the typical range of D&D games is meant to portray. It does a great job of capturing that sort of fantasy setting. But holy crap, does counting all the copper pieces when you're buying equipment really start to get annoying? God forbid if you're playing with the GM who uses encumbrance. You probably need to just quit the group at that point.
Absolutely.
But I think that's where we're going to go ahead and end this one. We did not get to talking about William's other point of setting bloat.
He only gets 5 internet points. I promised each person who gave a topic that we used on the air would get 10 internet points.
Well, all right. But just to be fair to William, though, I do want to come back to his topic. So he gets 5 points, and 5 are an escrow, possibly earning interest.
Possibly.
But they're not released to him yet. So he only has 5, but we have the other 5 in escrow.
Do you know that one of the people said, how would you use your internet points in a game? I read that. I'm like, oh, haha, that's pretty funny. And then I sent that out while I was eating lunch today. And then I got to thinking about it. And I'm like, oh my God, I can't stop thinking about how you use this in a game. So I came up with this idea. I mean, it's not really an original idea, but imagine you have a modern day game or even a future game, and every player makes an account on Facebook, Twitter, whatever, in character. And then they start using social media in character when they're not playing.
My God, I wouldn't play that game.
Well, you just play a character that wouldn't use social media.
Chad, as
like
for,
you play yourself.
There you go.
As for the internet points as a game mechanic, my guess is Bob Arns will have an answer by Fear the Con 5, and it will involve Rolos and a particle accelerator.
There is a game out there that uses social media in the game.
Really?
And it's Loot Crane. It's a Loot Crane game, and I played it at Fear the Con, and I have actually been trying to think of its name all day.
Burning Internet.
It's called Burning Internet.
Burning Internet.
Syphilis comes to the internet.
Burning Internet when you pee.
All right.
And I cannot think of the name of it.
So while Chad's thinking of that and somebody else is yelling at their MP3 player, the name of it, Fear the Con 5, Power 16 3. You guys have a great week and wonderful games, and we will catch you next week.
See ya.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2012. Listeners are free to use this show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.